The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
Start. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Wigginton. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Wigginton.
Good evening, listeners. Welcome to Tuesday evening Space Show program. I am your host, David Livingston, and we appreciate your tuning us in. We know there are other things competing with our valuable airtime tonight. How dare they? So we're happy that you have chosen to listen to us. And we have a great show planned because our guest is none other than Bob Zimmerman, who I will formally introduce in a minute, and he always provides us with stimulating and thought-provoking space discussion. For those of you who would like to call and talk to Bob, the toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. And remember, there are no call screeners here, and we'll answer the phone as quickly as we can and bring you up on air as quickly as we can. We will probably take a break tonight, so you can call during the break. We do answer the phone as well. You can also email us at drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. You can post comments or questions on our blog, which is our website, thespaceshow.com. All the way over to the far right is the upcoming show menu. This is the first show listed. It is also our blog and archive page. So open it up, and all the way down at the bottom, where you would post a blog comment, is where you would post a comment for the live broadcast. And as soon as you post it or send it, I'll get it and I can bring it up on air. Remember, you do not have to be logged in to discuss to do it. You can do so as a guest. And while you're at thespaceshow.com, our new website newsletter is uploaded. So check it out. It has all of the programs for this week listed. And it shows you what we have listed for upcoming shows. We only have a few more open dates for first quarter 2019. I mean, we're almost through with March. So if you do have guest suggestions or any other suggestion for us, please email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. We do try to respond to everybody and follow through. You may not get the answer you want, but you do get an answer, and it is always courteous, civil, and respectful. And as I said, a lot of guests come from suggestions from all of you. So don't hesitate to send us your thoughts on who you'd like to see or what topics on the Space Show. The full website newsletter is also posted, so check it out too, and you'll see all of the details of the programming. With one exception, Hotel Mars for this week has been canceled due to Mr. Bachelor not feeling well this week. So we hopefully will be able to resume Hotel Mars next week. So there will be no Hotel Mars program this week. Upper left menu, of course, has our Space Show store, so do check it out. It's under support. Hopefully you'll find some items of interest. And then also there's a Listen Live button, which tells you how to listen to podcasts, live broadcasts, archives off the website, and Amazon's Alexa. If you have any questions, don't hesitate to ask me, and feel free to share this information with other listeners. And then also further down on the center of the website is Supporting the Space Show. And remember, we're a listener-supported program, a nonprofit 501c3 with one, onegiantleapfoundation.org. If you like our programming, our guests, the blog, the interaction with the guest, the access to our guest, as well as to me, do support us, because without your support, we won't be doing the show. So we do very much need and appreciate your support. Remember, if you're a U.S. federal taxpayer, you get a tax deduction for your gift. And the same is true for your being a California taxpayer. And check out our parent page for the 501c3 nonprofit, onegiantleapfoundation.org. If you'd like to be an advisory board member on One Giant Leap's website, on the left-hand menu, you'll see an item called Team. Click on Team and a drop-down menu will come up, and click on Advisory Board. We're about to list the new advisory board members. It's a completely different advisory board for 2019. And read the guidelines. And if you're interested in being a member according to the guidelines, do email me and tell me, and let's see if we can work it out. And everybody's welcome. And, you know, there's no formal meetings. It's not going to take up a lot of your time. But I'm looking for people who genuinely care about the space show and are willing to help, and the guidelines will help you understand all of that. So tonight, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, Bob Zimmerman is back with us for all of the space news you can handle and more. So Bob has a fabulous website that, if you're not checking it out at least once a day, and probably to be really realistic about it, you need to visit it a couple times a day, behindtheblack.com. And also, February, Bob has a birthday. I don't know which day, but he considers the whole month his birthday. And that is his annual fundraising drive for Behind the Black. And none of this stuff is cheap to do anymore, and none of this stuff just grows out of thin air. So if you like Behind the Black, and I really think something might be wrong with you if you don't like it, you should very much support it. And we'll let Bob tell you more about his annual February birthday fundraising drive. But it is going on right now, and if you go to BehindTheBlack.com, you'll see more about it. And Bob is a great author. We've talked about many of his books, and you know about them, those of you who have been listening a long time. And Bob has a space opinion plus facts on just about every topic that you could possibly think of. In fact, one show, we ought to do one of these things, stump the guest, and let's see if you can come up with a space question or issue or subject that Bob doesn't know anything about. I'm not going to do that tonight, but I think that'd be a great space show. And
love it, David. Let's
see how many of you can
great
stump
idea.
Bob. Bob, welcome to the show. Happy birthday, whenever that may be.
It's today, or, David.
Oh, today.
Birthday today.
So you're choosing to spend your birthday with the space show and the listeners.
Yes. When you gave me the dates, I said, let's do it on my birthday. It'll be during the fundraising drive, and why not? My wife gives me permission. It's okay with her. And
well,
so here we are. Yes.
Terrific. So I'm going to start out doing something I don't normally start out doing, and that is reading you a listener question.
Oh, okay.
Usually I work them in later. So this was actually posted on our blog, but I'll read it to you. It's from Kim in Mexico, who unfortunately is unable to call you. So she says, Bob, I can't call, but I wanted to ask about the geosynchronous market issue. I have wondered about this market situation specifically for the Falcon Heavy because I, for one, can't understand the decision to push so aggressively towards a Super Heavy when the Falcon Heavy has barely flown. I have mused that an expendable Falcon 9 can deliver most of the payload that could also fly on a reusable Falcon Heavy, and that there are so few payloads too heavy for an expendable Falcon 9 that a Falcon Heavy's market is weak. It is very hard to find references for the payload capacity of a reusable Falcon Heavy, which strikes me as a bit suspicious. The capacity of an expendable Falcon 9 is about 23 tons. The best armchair analysis I can figure for the Heavy reusable is around 26 tons. Am I stumping you on this, or do you know anything about this? I've added the last line.
Yeah, I know you did. It's Kim, right? Is
Kim.
The question? Yes, Kim should have obviously be visiting Behind the Black, because I've actually got posts up today on this. In fact, there was an article that I saw from Space News today about the decline in the geosynchronous satellite industry contracts, orders, commercial orders in the last 2 years. There were 7 in 2017, and there were only 5 in 2018, which was a drop. They didn't expect it, and it's definitely the case. And it appears the analysis in that article is really good, and it appears that what's happening is that the satellite communications industry, at least for geosynchronous satellites, is kind of on a pause right now. They're waiting to see what kind of major breakthroughs are going to come in the small satellite constellation industry, which is beginning to crank up. And so we're seeing that change right there. And that brings us to the issue of the Falcon Heavy and the entire launch industry. This is a really good question that Kim asks, because it really goes right to the heart of what's happening in the entire launch industry. First, SpaceX comes along with the Falcon 9, reusable, much cheaper, cuts the cost anywhere from 50% to 75% to get them to space. And they have a large, actually, profit margin, because they're not, with the reusability, they're not dropping the price that much because they don't have to. No one else can match the prices they're giving. And so they have a bigger profit margin, and so they're taking advantage of that. And they make the Falcon Heavy. They do one launch last February, and now nothing until maybe next month, the next launch. A lot of the reasons for the delays for the two launches that are known to be on the manifest have been scheduled, that were scheduled for the third quarter of last year. Many of the reasons for those delays have been have not had anything to do with the Falcon Heavy or SpaceX. They've had to do with maybe one of them is an Air Force contract, and they probably are imposing restrictions and requirements that have caused delays. There have been scheduling issues. I also think that there were engineering questions. This is I want to put a caveat right at the start. This is pure speculation on my part. I don't have inside information, but I've been watching the space industry so long, I get my instincts are generally really good about these things. And so what I think might be going on here, partly the long delay, is that first Falcon Heavy launch, Elon Musk himself admitted this was really risky. The thing could blow up on the launch pad. He knew they were taking a real gamble, and they were pushing the engineering hard. And when I watched that launch, I have to tell you, the expressions and the emotional reaction of everyone at SpaceX that was narrating or providing commentary of that launch struck me that they themselves were astonished how much everything worked. That doesn't mean they're not good engineers. It just means they were really pushing the envelope. When they were done, the core was not able to land. They'd been pretty quiet about what the issues were. They had to redesign the core stage of the first stage extensively just to get it to launch, because they discovered it wasn't just simply strapping on three first stages together. There were major engineering changes that had to be done for the core stage. And it appears to me that they discovered in that launch engineering issues. That's my speculation, that they discovered some engineering issues that has taken them time to work through. That's part one reason, not the only, but one reason I think there was delays. And so, at the same time, Elon Musk starts to push for the big Falcon rocket, which he now calls Super Heavy and Starship. And in the process, I think he looked at the situation and he decided in the long run it would be better to build a rocket fresh. I think that's really the heart of his decision there. Now, I'm not getting yet into the industry changes and the customer demand. I'm just talking about their strategy right now. And I think he decided that they're developing the Raptor engine. It's going to be twice as powerful as the Merlin engine. They now know how to build reusable first stages, get them to launch and land. So why not? And they've already I think they already did the engineering studies about trying to bring the second stage back from a Falcon 9 or a Falcon Heavy, and realized that this was a leap too far. And so if you start from scratch, can you build something using what they know, and come up with a rocket that can do far more and cost far less? And that's what I think his thinking is. He's a smart man. He's one of the smartest guys on Earth. I would say this very clearly when it comes especially to space engineering and pushing that envelope. So he's asking these really intelligent questions, and so that's why they're building Starship Super Heavy. I think that's the thinking. And we have to rethink what they're building. They're not building a rocket that's going to fly and get thrown away periodically, even if it's reused like they're doing with the Falcon 9. No. In the long run, in the not-so-long run, and actually in a relatively short run, their goal is to be building two ships. They might build multiple of these two ships, but the first ship will be Super Heavy, whose job it is to get the thing off the ground. And it'll land and then do it again and again and again. And they're building a second ship, and that's Starship, whose purpose is to get into orbit and release payload or maybe bring people around the moon or beyond and then come back and do it again and again and again. And you, therefore, you have two ships. So in a sense, these names he came up with, Super Heavy and Starship, are class names, kind of like with ships, ocean liners, you know, frigates. I'm not a boat person, so I can't name the, but they come up with names for the class of ship you've got, and then you name the specific ships. And I think that's where he's going. And if he can, and with the knowledge this company has that nobody else has, remember, nobody else has been able to take a first stage back to the warehouse and inspect it after flight except SpaceX. So they have information that nobody else has, which allows them to look at how to build a reusable rocket like this new rocket. So that's where their thinking is coming from. And remember, you have to remember now, putting aside once again the industry market situation, Elon Musk's long-range goal is to get to Mars. His long-range goal is to colonize the solar system. That's what he wants to do. And now we get to the bifurcation of the launch industry. What Elon Musk is interested in requires bigger rockets. And so that's why he's going to that big rocket. The Falcon 9 could probably service smaller satellites. The Falcon Heavy is kind of caught in the middle. Because what is happening right now, and that's why I mentioned that article about the drop in the geosynchronous satellite industry, commercial orders, the commercial satellite industry right now is changing, and it's changing drastically. It looks very much like in the next decade, geosynchronous satellites are going to become, I don't want to say they're going to be completely obsolete. There's always a purpose for communicating. They can always be useful. But it looks very much like the entire industry is shifting to large, low-orbit or mid-orbit constellations of tiny CubeSat, SmallSat-type satellites. The whole industry is shifting that way because the technology is now allowing them to do that. And the advantage of that kind of constellation is several-fold. One, it's much cheaper to build each satellite. The satellites are not each one critical. If one fails, you've hardly heard lost anything. You've got a large constellation up there. They're cheaper to launch per satellite. And so all those things combined is pushing the industry, plus the technology's arrived, is pushing the industry in that direction. On top of that, we're beginning to see the arrival of small sat rocket companies that can launch these things individually. Now, that doesn't mean they won't be launched on, like, a Falcon 9 or India's PSLV polar orbit rockets. These are smaller rockets that can launch a bunch of these at a time, the small sats. But having the ability to also launch them precisely on orbit as a primary payload on these small sat rocket companies, small rockets, is increasing the value of going small in the satellite industry. And so that also brings us up to why SpaceX might have made the decision it's made, because Musk he's going to be building his giant Starlink constellation. He's almost certainly going to be using Falcon 9s to do it, and maybe Falcon Heavies, and maybe Super Heavy and Starship. But he also sees that there's possibly going to be a decline in customer base in the large geosynchronous satellite business that he has swept up and taken control of from stealing it from Russia, ULA, and Ariane Space in the last 4 years. And so his focus is big rockets to get people to Mars, and so he's focusing on that. Meanwhile, the industry is going through upheaval. I mean, whether, you know, SpaceX might end up owning the entire commercial geosynchronous industry because they're going to always be cheaper than everybody else, at least for the next decade. That's what it sure looks like right now. The only competitor that they appear to have might have been Blue Origin, but Blue Origin has decided to wed itself to the American Air Force, the military, which has automatically caused them to delay their first launch of New Glenn, and is probably going to increase the cost of that rocket. So can they compete with SpaceX? That's an open question. So the launch industry is shifting. I hope that this is, I've gone for a while, David. I think I've kind of answered Kim's question. Have I left anything out, or you think there's any gaps, or what have I missed?
No, I have the Space News article, so I'll post it in the archives.
Okay.
But I think you've covered it, and you have a caller on hold who may want to talk about this, but may want to talk about something else. Marshall is the caller. Hi, Marshall. Welcome to the show. How are you?
Hey, thank Kim for being a wonderful lead into my question. I have been seeing rumors and little bits here and there, space.com, talking about a BFR hopper. And one of the key questions I have is, obviously, Falcon Heavy was a paradigm shift, huge paradigm shift. Is a successful flight of the Hopper going to be a paradigm shift in itself, or does SpaceX actually have to get BFR into orbit to really be a significant impact on the world of spaceflight?
Well, Marshall, thank you for calling again. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. I hope the farm work is going well. I would actually disagree with you. I don't think Falcon Heavy was the paradigm shift. I think Falcon 9, with the landing of the first stages, was the paradigm shift. All Falcon Heavy did was say, we can build, we can show you we can do a heavy lift cheap and quick, reasonably quick. And true, they did that, but the paradigm shift was really landing that first stage. As for, and I don't want to call it BFR anymore, Big Falcon Rocket, because they've changed the name. They've got a decent name. It's Super Heavy and Starship, and I'd rather work with those names. The Hopper is, all the Hopper is the equivalent of Grasshopper, which was a test prototype, first stage of Falcon 9 when they were trying to figure out how to land the first stage. And it was just a prototype for the purposes of engine, of testing, flight tests. And so all the Hopper is, and that's the thing they're assembling at Boca Chica down the southern tip of Texas at their space facility there. That's gotten a lot of press because the pictures are really spectacular. It looks like something out of the 1950s spaceship.
That's exactly my comment.
Yeah.
I wonder if they're real or not.
And in fact, Elon Musk saw it as well. When he posted a picture of it, he put it next to a picture of a simulation, which almost could have come out of a 1950s pulp science fiction book, and he says, this is real. This is not a comic book. But nonetheless, what they're building down there is a similar prototype for testing landing that first stage, and the Super Heavy and the Starship version as well. Now, the Starship version, it's going to be very difficult for them to actually do the real tests because Starship is designed to come back from orbit. So it's really isn't going to be, it's the hard part of that is not going to be the landing, seriously, because the actual landing is something they now know how to do and have done many, many times. The area that's an unknown for Starship is returning through the atmosphere from orbital speeds and shedding that speed safely without burning up so that you then can land accurately as before. And that's its engineering problem. The Hopper is mainly going to be testing vertical landing with this larger spaceship, the Super Heavy, the larger size, the larger framework with the Raptor engines, because they also be testing those engines as well. That's a new engine they're developing for this. And so that's what that Hopper is going to be doing. It's not going to be any different from, it's not the paradigm shift. The paradigm shift is the real paradigm shift with Super Heavy Starship will be when they launch it. And it won't be a paradigm shift when they land Super Heavy because they've shown they can do that. The paradigm shift will be if they can get Starship into orbit, which will be a heavy lift, reusable ship comparable to the shuttle, if not superior, and then bring it back and be able to reuse it. And that's the real next paradigm shift, because when they do that, they will have built a completely reusable spaceship. Completely reusable, rocket vehicle for getting payload, lots of payload into orbit at reasonable cost. So I hope that answers your question, Marshall. I think it runs right down the line.
The reasonable cost is where the accountants get through with all of it after it lands. And that may be the real paradigm shift.
Well, you know, the SpaceX does not allow its bean counters to determine how they will design things and launch. If they had allowed bean counters in the rocket industry to tell them what to do, they would not have had reusable ships, because bean counters and some dumb engineers and managers have been saying for decades that you can't do that. It's not cost effective. You will use up all your fuel. You'll not be able to get anything up to geosynchronous orbit. And they've demonstrated that's not true. But they're not going to allow bean counters to determine things for them. That's for sure. I mean, Marshall, just let me add one more point. If bean counters would have told them to take the Air Force contracts that were being offered for developing new rockets, ULA took it for its Vulcan. Blue Origin took it for its New Glenn. Northrop Grumman took it for its variation of its, I don't think they're calling it Liberty anymore, but their solid rocket. And all three of them took money, but all three of them now face delays because they have to meet Air Force requirements. And SpaceX officials, and I have a video of one of them saying so on Behind the Black, have said clearly that we decided we don't want that money, even though the bean counters would love them to take those big $500 million to $1 billion subsidies, because that will we'll have to do things the way the Air Force wants, and we want to build it the way we think it should be done.
I think you're absolutely correct. Time to let somebody else chat.
Okay. Thank you, Marshall, as always. Pleasure to talk.
Bye.
Thank you, Marshall. Listeners, I'm trying something a little new tonight. We do have sponsors for the space show, so I'm going to read their messages intermittently from time to time rather than all up front, because I don't think anybody listens when I read them all in a batch. But we thank Northrop Grumman, who is a leading global security company, very innovative systems and solutions for government and commercial customers going from undersea to outer space and cyberspace. And we thank the Space Foundation. They have their big event coming up. And again, it is always at the Broadmoor in Colorado Springs. It's in April. And spacesymposium.org will get you all the information you need to know. And we have other sponsors. I'll tell you about them as we go through the program.
David, I want to add one more sponsor, because I have sponsors sent you money, and I'm on your board of advisors, so people, please consider Behind the Black as a place to send money as well. I've got a fundraiser going on right now. I could use the money. I need that to keep that thing going. It's hard work.
So what do they get for...
giving money? I'm not giving out any kind of bonuses or prizes.
No, that isn't what I meant. Tell them a little bit about, I always talk about Behind the Black, but give them like the 101 on it. That's what I meant.
Absolutely fine, David. Yes, Behind the Black is my website for me to post on a daily basis news and articles on what I think are important, not just in space, but in science, technology, and culture. I do focus mostly on science and space, but if I see something that I think is significant, that means something to me and is affecting our future, I'll write about it. And so I post many things every day. One of the things, it changes as my interests change. And so in the last 6 months, I've gotten very intrigued by exploring the image archives of the various planetary probes out there. We're mostly stuck with just the Mars images right now. There's some from Jupiter, but I go through those archives, and I periodically will post images and with commentary and detailed geological analysis, because I have some experience now. I'm not a geologist, but as a caver, I have a great deal of knowledge about geology. So I will post images images of some really interesting things that I see. And so if you're interested in space, this is a place to go to really see the update on what's going on step by step. Like, for example, Kim's question about the launch industry has been covered on Behind the Black repeatedly over the last 3 months. The beginning of the year, I always post my annual launch analysis, where if you go and do a search on Behind the Black for worldwide launches, you will get to a post that I did where I actually gave the list of launches per year through 2019, and you could see who did what, when, the trends from nation to nation and company to company, and I give some analysis on that. And so going to Behind the Black would help answer these questions before I'm even on the air. In terms of pictures, today I posted a spectacular image, and it's not just the specific image, but where it's located, of a pit on Mars that undeniably is the location for a future Martian colony because of the components thereof. You go to the website, you can see the images are kind of cool, and where it's located is really amazing. And I'm looking at this, and I'm actually thinking, because of the shrinking, because of the story today on the Marcos CubeSats that worked so successfully for the InSight mission to Mars. They were cheap to build to get to Mars. And we have now the new small sat rocket. I'm thinking to myself, Jesus, somebody should put together a rover mission to Mars, and I'd like to go to this specific place and get a rover into this pit, because it looks like it's very accessible. You could drive down into it. It's not a pit on all sides. It's got a nice room. So anyway, so that's the kind of stuff I post on Behind the Black, and if people are interested, they should take a look, and they should consider supporting it. And if you don't want to if you want to get something back for your support, you don't have to necessarily send money to Behind the Black. You could also buy the books that I have there, you know, my various books, my science fiction book Pioneer, and Genesis, you know, it's out now on Apollo 8, it's out in an audiobook and an ebook. So I hope that covers it, David. I don't want to go on too long.
Well, and you also have entertainment interludes posted on the Behind the Black, which I find really great.
Every evening during the week, I have something called an evening pause, in which I post something that isn't political generally. It isn't space related. It's entertainment or intriguing in some manner. I would say about 80% of the evening pauses I post are suggested to me by readers. Since people want to even participate in Behind the Black, they can send me suggestions for evening pauses, and I post them. For the first 3 years of the website, I was posting every day, not just on the week. I was finding things to post every single day. And after 3 years, I was meaning to burn out, and I started to stop. And one of my readers emailed me and said, hey, don't stop. And I said, well, I'm really burnt. She said, well, I'll send you some. And so I sent out a suggestion that people send me. She sent me some, and then others started to send me, and I've now been going for almost 3 years continuous, more than that, 4 years continuously, with about 80% of the suggestions coming from readers. So people are welcome to suggest.
Yeah, I've sent a couple to him that he has put up. You have another caller. So
okay, let's go to the call.
Let's shamelessly get away from the promotion.
Yeah, well, you know,
pay the bill. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you? Where are you? Thank you for calling, Bob.
Hi, it's Gary in Kansas City. How are you guys doing this evening?
We're doing okay, and you?
Doing great, Gary.
Great, great. Hey, Bob, congratulations on another trip around the sun.
You're most welcome. The more the merrier. It's,
real quick, I know you had a recent visit to Vector Space here in Tucson. I wonder if you'd want to tell us a little bit more about your visit there. That sounds like an interesting thing that you've done there.
Oh, yeah. Vector Launch is its actual corporate name, though they just go by Vector most of the time. Vector Launch, okay. Vector is a company that's one of those small sat rocket companies, and they've been based in Tucson from the beginning, and about 2 years ago I was offered a tour by their CEO Jim Cantrell, and I did, and I posted on Behind the Black a my visit, and that was when they were in a small, tiny warehouse, and it really looked like people building rockets out of their garage. But the reason I went is because Cantrell had been very successful to pull in a lot of investor capital. I mean, a lot. It was serious business. And so I gave a report on that and, you know, outlined where they were going to go. And then earlier in this year, I noticed that the launch schedule, test flight schedule that he had told me about 2 years previously had not followed through in exactly the way he promised. So that suggests changes or problems. And I got a chance to see him at a talk in Tucson. They have something here called the Tucson Space Business Roundtable, meets every month, and he was going to give a lecture, and I came to that, and so I pinned him down and said, hey, I'd like to get an update on your launch schedule. Why didn't you do the launches you said you were going to do? And he says, well, it's pretty simple, and blah, blah, blah. And so he said, well, I talked to him, I talked to two other people in his company at that lecture, and the end result is it was just confusing because they have a multitudinous number of rockets being prepped. And so he said, look, let me give you another tour. And so I went and had a tour, and he was able to get a very clear idea of what their schedule is going to be over the rest of the year. I was very impressed. If they're not in that little warehouse anymore, they've gotten more investment capital, and they have a very now large warehouse building. Their employees have gone from about 30 to about 150. And so they're building rockets, and they're building, they've got on the floor of their factory, they've got two rockets being assembled right now. And those rockets are going to launch hopefully one in March of April of this year, and the second in June of this year. And the March-April launch is not going to be an orbital launch, but it'll be a launch of the first stage completely, and then the second stage will be tested in terms of separation and opening valves and seeing if the stage can fire. There will be no fuel in it, just water, but they will be going that far. And then the next launch, they hope to go in June, which would be an actual orbital launch, and then followed with August, and then another in October, and then two in maybe December. That's their plan. So there could be a lot of launches from them this year. They showed me a lot of stuff. I showed pictures on Behind the Black of a bunch of different things, their launch floor, their what they call their TEL, which is for transport, erect, and launch. This is a truck, literally. It's the back part of a truck that they put their rockets on and drive it down the highway to take it to wherever they're going to launch. They don't need anything more than a concrete pad and a spaceport that has licensing to permit them to launch to go. And so they showed me that. And they also showed me they're building a vertical test stand. They're going to be actually doing vertical tests, static fire tests, for their first stage rocket, and that's coming up. It's an impressive setup. They definitely are serious, and they're making rockets. They're going to have to fire the rockets and get them into orbit for people to take them seriously. There's no question of that. Well, let me rephrase that, actually. It's not exactly right. In order for them to really become a big, a permanent, real player in the small set industry, they're going to have to get this rocket into orbit. They right now are being taken very seriously because they got lots of money, investment capital. People are willing to take risks with them because they have shown themselves to be smart and with the good ideas. Cantrell especially knows how to sell this, and he's smart. He's talking intelligently. And so that's good, but they're going to have to get this into orbit to become a real player. They are about three to 6 months behind the schedule. It's behind the schedule he told me 2 years ago with some caveats involved. They were supposed to have their third launch in the summer of last year, followed by their fifth orbital launch in December. And they canceled that third launch, and they've gone to a slightly different schedule this year. So I'd say 6 months to 8 months behind schedule. This is not a terrible thing for a new company like this, by no means. It's not a big deal. But nonetheless, they're going to have to make it happen to become a big player. a real player. Mm-hmm. But they are one of three companies right now that are in the race to dominate that industry and that are in the lead. And, of course, Rocket Lab's in the lead. Virgin Orbit has moved into second place because they look like they're going to do their orbital launch in the spring this year. We'll see. But that's what they're saying.
Yeah. Any idea where they're going to maybe launch from, the vector?
The launches are all going to be out of Alaska. The upcoming launches are right now planned out of Alaska. I actually asked Jim Cantrell specifically why Alaska, and he says, well, it's actually right now for us, it's the easiest licensing situation, and it's the most convenient and least costly. There are launch facilities on the east and west coast of the United States are both government run and are difficult, to put it mildly, work with. If you've got a lot of launches and you're a big company, you can push through that and make it work more effectively. But for a small company like him, it's hard. And so they're looking for other sites. They looked at the South Pacific island that SpaceX initially used for its Falcon 1, but the distances are hard for that. They've looked at Camden, Georgia, but that's not approved yet, and there's issues there. They've looked at a variety of other spaceports in the U.S., but all of them are not really ready to go. And so this one is, more or less. There's bureaucracy there as well that they've had to deal with, but it's the least of anything, and they say at least cost. So that's where they're going.
Mm-hmm. So have you talked to you get a chance to visit with the employees, the actual people on the floor a little bit?
Oh, yeah. I got to talk to a few of them. It was really cool talking to them because my sense in talking to them is that this space industry is really tiny. A lot of them came from SpaceX or other companies, all the companies, but mostly the new companies. Some of them moved from – one of them actually I talked to I'd have to look up his name. I don't have his name written down. He gave me his name, but I didn't write up in the. He's a guy who works in the. It looks like in the electrical wiring harness area, the satellite design. But he worked for SpaceX. Then he went to Virgin Orbit, and then he switched over to Vector. And I asked him, why did he leave SpaceX? And he said, oh, it was a great job, best job I ever had. But I was working 60, 70, 80 hours a week, and the opportunity to be able to work a more normal lifestyle was very appealing. And so I went and switched to this company. And that makes sense. I can understand that. I talked to other guys, too, that have gone from company. And I asked one guy about it. Is this a small industry? He says, yep, once you're in and you're known within the industry as someone who's really good, smart, and knows how to get things done, everyone's going to know you, and you'll be able to move around pretty well. And in fact, this has nothing to do with Vector specifically, but the SpaceX layoffs 2 weeks ago, they've announced they're dropping 10% of their space force. I've gotten contacts from people who say, hey, I had one guy, my son's been laid off. He's looking for work. Can you make suggestions of companies? And I said, well, these are the ones I would go to. And then he came back and says, well, he went to this other one. And I said, well, that's another one that's in this small group of people. And, you know, it's not a big industry, I can tell you that much. And if you're good, and once again, get things done. That's a consistent pattern from everybody I talk about in these successful companies. They're not looking for super smart, really. They're looking for people who will get things done. Jim Cantrell told me that actually the day I was at that tour, he had to let a guy go who was brilliant, but he was too interested in making really cool designs instead of getting it done. And after a while, they said, this is not cost effective. We need to get things built. So he's out the door. And so I think for anyone who's interested in the business, I'm giving them really strong advice on what to do.
Well, how cool is it? We live in a time where there's actually some choices to bounce around a little bit. That hadn't been that long ago. There's, you know, you go to NASA or Boeing, and that's about it, you know.
And the worst part of it is you would get jobs at NASA and Boeing and Lockheed Martin, and you were faced with the reality that you might not build anything for your entire career. You'd be building PowerPoint presentations. and that's what's changed. When I give talks, I'm on the distinguished lecturer list for the American Institute of Astronautics and Aeronautics. that. So I routinely am asked by their sections and their student chapters to come and give lectures. I did that in Buffalo. I wrote up something on Behind the Black on that. That was very cool. I'm going to be in Dayton, and I'm going to be in Tennessee later on in the spring doing the same thing. And I routinely, I'm routinely asked by the students, what would you do if you were getting, looking for a job right now? And I say, and I always say to them, the last place I would get a job right now is at NASA. And I would definitely try to avoid SLS and Orion as a place to work, because you're going to get, you're going to be training bad habits, and you're not going to be getting the kind of resume material that you want for cutting metal and building things. And it's really the heart of the matter. If you're being an engineer, don't you want to build things? Don't you want to have your rocket fly into space, or your satellite, or your planetary probe? I mean, this is what you really want. And there hasn't been much opportunity for that for most of the second half of the 20th century. And we are now, for the last decade and a half, David knows this, I've talked repeatedly about how we've been in a transition out of a government-run space program and transitioning into an old-fashioned American space industry, chaotic and competitive. And that transition is beginning to close down, and we're moving into the reality of it now, and that's wonderful. It's wonderful.
What a great opportunity to go actually see a real rocket company, private industry, things happening. I think that would just be a treat, just to have a chance to
I'm
hopefully know in a place.
Yes,
like that.
I might not know how to do any of the engineering, but it's always cool to see this stuff,
yeah,
always.
Very cool, very cool. All right, Bob, hey, I appreciate your efforts on Behind the Black, and try to catch these shows when I can, and I took a little opportunity to throw a little in the tip jar there at Behind the Black. I want to keep you guys running and jumping, and thanks again for all your good stuff you do there on the web and on your website. And I enjoy every minute of it. Hey, anyway, so you guys have a good evening.
And you too, Gary. Thank you for the contribution. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for your time here tonight. So I'll listen up. Talk to you guys later.
Thank you, listeners. We're a little beyond the halfway point. I'm going to take a quick pause for our break. But first, let me thank Moonwords as a sponsor. And this, again, I'm scattering the sponsor comments, trying it out tonight. But Moonwords suggests that what if a group of nations was determined to build a town on the moon and they based their decisions on technical and economic merit? Moonwords is building a digital vision of that town where you will be able to learn, play, build, and go to events. Visit moonwords.com and download an early draft demo of the town. And you can help fund its development by subscribing. Help us help the world see a bigger future where we can leave our past behind us. And, of course, AIAA is a sponsor and has been with us for a very, very long time. They are the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. They're the world's largest aerospace professional society. They have 5 conferences or events a year. Great networking. They have a library of going back decades of reviewed papers on just about every imaginable engineering or business or management or science or this or that issue arising in space. And you can access that library. Visit them at AIAA.org. So everybody stay where you are. We'll be back with Mr. Zimmerman in 3 minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of the Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And the Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality. And welcome back, everybody. Part two of the Space Show. Our guest is Bob Zimmerman. As for our second segment sponsors, let's lead off with the Space Development Organization. And if you're interested in space settlement, this is for you. Would you like to see space settlement occur within your lifetime? The Space Development Network is an online organization allowing you to join together with others to advance the plan for space development. It's free, and they need people with a wide variety of skills and interests. So check it all out at spacedevelopment.org, and then the Integrated Space Plan sponsors us. Remember, this is a highly detailed development chart showing the path to becoming spacefaring, and you can see how technology and destinations build upon one another. Explore hundreds of individual elements in detail. Their website is thespaceplan.com. You can buy your own copy of the plan in one of two kinds and sizes. It's very inspirational. It's suitable for framing, hanging on the wall, or a door. And you should check it out, and your kids will love it. They'll learn from it. thespaceplan.com. And Bob Zimmerman is our guest tonight. Our toll-free number, if you would like to call us, 1-866-687-7223. And Bob, what's going on with Commercial Crew?
Nothing.
Well, that's quick. Next.
We're done. No, it's the most infuriating thing to me, what's been going on with Commercial Crew, because it's very clear to me that the that this is, more than anything else, demonstrates how little interest there is in NASA for getting people into space. They are not interested in the slightest in getting that accomplished. They are only interested in protecting their interests and their agendas. And if that means that the nation will suffer because of it, that management and bureaucracy in NASA will do anything it can to protect itself, even if it hurts the nation. And that's what's going on here. Because SpaceX, from all I can tell, has been pretty much ready to launch. They delivered the crew capsule, Dragon capsule, to Cape Canaveral almost 6 months ago. And, you know, they had stuff they still had to do to get ready for that launch, but they were pretty much ready to go in December. They said they were ready to go in December. NASA said there were scheduling issues with ISS, so they couldn't launch in December. And some of that was legitimate because of the Russian problems with their Soyuz capsule and their launch problem. I could see that. So they said they're going to launch in January. And then there were delays, and there were delays, and there were delays. And all these delays NASA attributes to technical issues and paperwork and safety questions, none of which are clearly delineated, and all of which seem to be hogwash. SpaceX, in the interim, has done two static fire dress rehearsals, launch countdown dress rehearsals with their rocket and capsule, with the second one including countdown to zero, which they then did a static fire test to demonstrate everything works. So they've done this now twice. This is more than they normally do on any one of their launches. They use their own launch pad, leased to them for 20 years, now about 18 years left on the lease. They use their own launch crew, which is why they could do this. They've launched in the interim, even though there was a government shutdown. They don't need NASA to actually launch, except when the capsule needs to dock with ISS. Well, guess what? So during the launch, they would need mission control and astronauts. Well, guess what? Those essential personnel, they were working during the launch, during the government shutdown, so they would have been there to do their job. So there's absolutely no reason that I can see, and I've not seen one word about a real technical issue preventing this from going on, except NASA's safety panel blathering about parachutes one time and the fueling procedure another time, and the Block 5 hasn't been flown a lot of times, and this and that and that and this, and every one of those complaints has been hogwash, has been joke, it's been unrealistic, it's not been valid. And so as far as I can tell, the people standing in the way of our ability to the American nation returning to space in our own rockets and capsules is NASA. And I find it despicable. It also tells me something about Donald Trump, who's blathering away in his State of the Union speech tonight, and I never listen to those. Doesn't matter which party does it, because they're always blather. It's all public relations. It's not reality. You're not finding out anything really new when you listen to that speech. But Trump went to Washington to clean the swamp, to drain the swamp, to represent the American interests. Well, the American interests are not being well served here by NASA, and he's in a position to have changed something like that, and he hasn't done anything. He's allowing NASA to slow things down. And I think part of the politics of NASA's bureaucracy slowing SpaceX down is to try to make it so that Boeing isn't beaten into space. Because Boeing is a long-time contract. I'm speculating here, but I just know the politics that go on here. And Boeing is a long-time contractor. They're buddy-buddy with NASA and a lot of the upper-ups at NASA. And they don't want Boeing to look bad. And Boeing has always trailed SpaceX. And though both companies have been delayed by NASA's bureaucracy, SpaceX has been delayed a lot more. And the irony is that SpaceX was much more closer to launching when these contracts were issued and could have launched probably 2 years ago if NASA hadn't gotten in the way. And they probably could have launched with a more flexible, smarter capsule using Super Draco engines to land vertically rather than parachutes landing on land. But it was NASA who said you can't do that. And so they've gone back to an old-fashioned splashdown with this capsule. So yeah, I'm kind of pissed at this, and it really irritates me no end.
So you would dismiss NASA saying there are safety concerns that they need to look into?
I haven't yet seen a real valid safety concern from NASA about either of these spacecraft, Boeing or SpaceX's Dragon. No, I haven't seen anything valid. I've seen a lot of junk, complaints about issues that were not that. All right, okay, let's take a close look at this. I won't ever argue if you want to take a close look at good engineering to make sure it's not going to miss something. There's nothing wrong with that. But the same safety panel sees no problems at all with the SLS program and Orion, which are doing things far more risky and with far less testing or security. To them, the only thing wrong with SLS is it's not getting enough money. Even though it gets, 10 times as much.
Right.
And it's taking 5 times as long. So that's why I have very little respect for the safety panel. I have contempt for the space safety panel, and I'd be glad to discuss this with a safety panel person because I think they're full of it. And and especially when I've seen reports from them where they specifically say, well, the big obstacle here is that SpaceX might not be able to get all the paperwork filled out. We have lots of paperwork they have to do to make sure things are good. And I hear that and I say, this is ridiculous. And this is the kind of thing that Trump should be cleaning up. It's absurd.
Who is on the safety? Who is ahead of the safety?
At the moment, I can't tell you off the names. I've seen them before, and I've looked at it, but I'd have to go do a search on the web, and I'm on the air right now, so it would be hard for me.
What
to
is
do
the
it
official name? Maybe I can see if the guy will come on.
I know. Let's see. I'm doing a...
Of the panel. What's the official panel called?
National ASAP, that's it. I'm at their website right now. The NASA Aerospace Safety Advisory Panel. Here, meet the names of the people. Let's see. Left to right, Mr. David West, Dr. Donald McAerlin, Ms. Everett Watley, Dr. Patricia Sanders, ASAP Chair, Ms. Carol Hamilton, Executive Officer, General Lester Lyles, Miss Paula Frankel, Captain Christopher Sandon, and Andy Shaw. Some of these people I've actually seen. I think it was McAerlin, I might be mispronouncing his name, who was the one who gave the talk stating, the presentation stating, well, they haven't filled out the paperwork. And that's going to really delay things, and it's a problem. So I challenge any one of these people. I'll talk to them. I think they're full of it, and I'm really – they've got more – let's see. There's others, Lieutenant General Susan Hemm. They have a list here. Captain Brent W. Jett, retired. Former astronaut. There's a few former astronauts there, but these are all NASA people, and as far as I'm concerned, they're full of it. They have lost their credibility in my mind because of how they've delayed this. I'm sorry for being so diplomatic.
Well, maybe they'll hear about you from this show and decide to respond to you.
Sure, I'd love to see their response. I'd like to see a real justification for some of the delays. I'm sorry. I mean, the one thing that really struck me is when they were claiming that Boeing's parachute system for the Starliner had problems. And I scratched my head because Boeing's been building, and the nation has been building parachutes for capsules for 50 years. Boeing has been doing it for a long time, and for them to suddenly say that they don't know how to make a parachute release system struck me as very suspicious. I'm sorry, I just find it suspicious. To demand numerous additional tests, I found very suspicious. Look, one of the things that I found really, really disgusting was they demand that SpaceX launch their Block 5 Falcon 9 rocket 7 times successfully before they will allow a Dragon manned launch. Now, okay, maybe that's a reasonable request, but what are they doing with SLS, this same safety panel? They actually were considering the idea of launching astronauts on its first,
right,
the first launch of its upper stage, which fortunately they don't have to do right now for other reasons, but they were actually considering putting that, the safety panel was considering the idea of, NASA presented it to them, the idea of let's put astronauts on that first launch because we can't really afford to do multiple launches with this to test it. So that tells me that they're political and they're not really interested in safe. They play politics.
Does SpaceX respond to any of this or they just play nice?
SpaceX is very shrewd. I don't have any inside information, but I watch what goes on, and it's very clear. SpaceX, NASA's their biggest customer. They don't want to upset NASA. They're going to serve. The customer's always right. They're going to try to make that customer happy. But they play very good politics, SpaceX, to apply pressure to NASA when bureaucrats at NASA are trying to slow them down. And those two dress rehearsals in January were a prime example of that. There's no question. I mean, they would have wanted to do those dress rehearsals anyway. SpaceX is the company way of doing things. It's that what that company does. But they did those, I think, almost to demonstrate that any of the delays having to do with the government shutdown has nothing to do with them. And there's no reason to delay the launch because of the government shutdown. And they did those also to apply pressure to NASA's bureaucracy to stop delaying the launch itself. It's another reason why they apply, I think, for FCC licenses for dates in January and February to apply pressure to NASA. This is a game. It's a political game they have to play, but they're playing, and they play it very shrewdly. They're not going to fight NASA publicly or even privately in a the way I am. They're not. They have to be diplomatic, and I don't blame them for that. But they know, no doubt, they apply pressure, and they apply pressure smartly, so that there's, you know, at a certain point, their delaying tactics are going to run out of steam, and that's what's happening right now. We're not far from a launch. They cannot delay it much more.
Listeners, our line is open. Bob is waiting to hear from you. 1-866-687-7223, and all of your topics are available if you want to talk to Bob. Email drspace@thespaceshow.com. Bob, on open lines on Sunday, surprisingly, one of the top topics for discussion was what's going on, and I know you'll know something about this. It's not 100% space-related, but it touches on it, is the Russian-U.S. stuff about the INF treaty and what constitutes a space weapon and THAAD and all sorts of related things on missile defense. Are these weapons? Are we putting weapons in space? Is Russia trying to put weapons in space? What about the treaty? Why get out of it? What do you know, and how do you see things with that treaty, Russia, the United States?
Well, we're out of the treaty now. We've announced we're out.
Well, we have 6 months.
Yes, but we're out. I mean, that's the position that the they might be able to change, but I don't think Russia's going to do anything to change their mind. If anything, Russia's going to
Well, they've already said they're out. Russia's pulled out, too.
Yeah, and Russia's already announced that they're accelerating development of a variety of missiles that would fall under that treaty now. And so treaty's dead.
Yeah, and we think they've been doing them all along.
That's
which
right.
is why Trump wants to get us out of it, because they're violating the treaty.
Yeah, when we dropped out of the treaty, I had a post on Behind the Black, and the articles that I could find about us pulling out were vague about the specific, and your callers might have had better information, but the articles were vague about the specific missile defense development that was violating the treaty. I theorized it might be this hypersonic missile that the Russians have been developing or claiming to develop.
Claiming, right.
Yeah, everything I've read about the hypersonic seems to me to fit right into a violation of that INF treaty. And so, yes, they've been violating it for decades. I wouldn't have any doubts about that. And unlike the previous administrations, this is where Trump is different. He's not afraid of shaking up the status quo. And this is the kind of thing that just has not happened for the last 25 years by either president of either party. You've got a clear violation. You've got to walk away. You've got to tell them you mean business. They were not taking us seriously, I think. They thought they realized they could get away with it because nobody in previous administrations from either party was willing to walk away. And so Trump has told them we're willing to walk away, and they know that now. Now, if they get into another arms race with us, their economy is suffering right now. They're in worse shape now than they were in many ways in the 1980s when they went bankrupt with again a missile race with us. So they have a problem, and this is where Trump is strong. He knows how to negotiate, and he in order to negotiate properly in a deal, you've got to tell them you're willing to walk away unless you give them a good deal. So that's how I see it right now. It is bad in the long run, in the short run, because we are faced with possibly a rebirth of the nuclear Cold War.
Yeah.
The difference is that people today are just not taking it seriously. Americans today don't seem to take any corruption in government seriously. They don't seem to even notice. They don't seem to even care. And we are faced that pulling out of the INF was hardly covered in the press. They're too busy talking about really stupid things that have nothing to do with anything. But this is a big piece of news. This would have been major headlines 40 years ago because it's a big deal. It signals the possible rebirth of a nuclear arms race. That is not something anyone should want. We have been blessed since 1991 with the fall of the Soviet Union that the nuclear arms race and the threat of nuclear war was defused. And for the last 25, 30 years, we have not been threatened by such a thing. It's not been considered even on the glimmer of anyone's eye. It's not been brought up. No one considers it as a risk, but now that could be returning. And that's big news, and that's something we should be worried about. That doesn't mean the Trump administration is necessarily wrong, because if the Russians are violating, you're then in that arms race anyway, and you've got to do something to try to either defuse it or stop it, and just standing around and letting them violate the treaty is not going to accomplish that. So Trump's taking a different tact. I should point out that he's been remarkably successful in turning things around in foreign policy in a number of places by demonstrating a willingness to walk away, a willingness to be hard-nosed, and at the same time a willingness to listen. And I could cite North Korea and the Middle East as and China as three places where he has managed to get results. Remarkable results that were considered impossible by the status quo establishment in Washington from both parties for the last 25 years.
Do you think we're weaponizing space? That was a big part of the topics on the Open Line show.
That's one of those straw man, left-wing, liberal bugaboos that is just absurd. Space will always have a military component if you have sovereign nations. That's going to be a fact of life. Are we westernizing space? We have been launching surveillance and reconnaissance satellites, and the Russians and the Chinese, and Israel and the Middle East and India and Pakistan for 50 years. That's going on. It's always going to go on. Right now, the American military is very concerned about the fact that in the last 20 years, they have fallen into the trap of depending on big, expensive, one-time, rarely launched satellites to do their jobs, to do the GPS, to do the communications, to do the surveillance. And they realize those are vulnerable to being destroyed by enemies. And they're also expensive and risky because you have no redundancy. One goes out on launch or in construction or in orbit quickly, and you're screwed. You're in a bad way. And so the military's been trying to shift to, once again, these small-sat constellations. There's at least a move within the military to do this. This is one of the reasons Trump brought up the Space Force. He really wasn't trying to create, you know, a military. Well, he might have been. But the real issue there has always been an effort within the military, a turf war within the military, within its bureaucracy, between the people who like the big satellites because it's a thing on their lapel, and people who want to change how the military does things to get small, lots of satellites launched. That you have redundancy, you're protected from attack that way. So are we going to weaponize space? Well, eventually we will. I've talked about one of the reasons space is going to get weaponized much more quickly than it should, because we're stuck under the Outer Space Treaty, because the Outer Space Treaty outlaws sovereign nations from claiming any territory. Sovereign nations, the laws of sovereign nations cannot be applied to any territory in space. So if American businesses begin to establish businesses on the moon or Mars or on an asteroid, they're going to need the government's protection, because other nations will feel they have a right to move in. And according to the Outer Space Treaty, they will have the right to move in. And so that's going to almost force it. You're going to be forced to use might to protect your rights. Legal law is how you reduce the need for military force. And unfortunately, the Outer Space Treaty makes that impossible. And so, are we going to weaponize space? Yeah, it's going to happen. I mean, you can't make believe it's not going to happen. What you got to do is try to figure out ways to make it practical, less threatening, and allow those nations in space to work together or competitively in a peaceful manner. I had an op-ed 2 years ago in the Federalist where I said, Trump really wants to change the paradigm in space. He should pull out of the Outer Space Treaty and propose a new treaty whereby you create a national homesteading policy where nations can claim territory, will have the right to claim territory, will have a system for claiming territory in space, and that'll increase competition, and it'll allow legal framework for owning property in space, not just for individuals, but for nations. And once you've done that, you create a framework that precludes the need for military action. The nations of the world will be more likely to leave things alone if there's a framework, rules they all work under. And they don't have that right now.
Let me read the listener question. Ted in San Diego says, Bob, I'm taking it to mean that you would support a separate U.S. Space Force, not part of the Air Force. Is that your position?
No. I didn't really go into details there. Trump made a big deal about a Space Force, and a lot of people, including him to a certain extent, took that to mean he wants to absolutely create a new branch in the military with guys having lasers and rockets and space cadet uniforms, military soldiers going out in space to shoot down Chinese satellites and astronauts. Of course, I'm being a little facetious when I describe that, but it's not very far away from what I saw some of the mainstream press. It was really ridiculous. What was going on in the military, as I've said, for the last 10 years, is an effort, a battle within the military to reshape the bureaucracy of space. Right now, it's distributed across the branches of the military, mostly in the Air Force, but there's other divisions as well, and it therefore doesn't have any central command, which means it doesn't have any, it has little power. And so the needs of the other branches sometimes supersede what the space division or what the military needs to do in space. The other needs supersede it. And this is politics. This is the bureaucracy, not interested in the interests of the nation, but interested in its own interests. And so there have been good people in the military, in the Pentagon, who've been trying to push through a restructuring of the bureaucracy to put it all under one office. They've actually been trying to do this for about 3 or 4, 5, 6 years. And what Trump did, and this is his bombastic way of doing things moves things forward. He talks about a space force, a military branch, but what the real goal in doing that is to get that negotiation off the ground to create this one bureaucracy, centralized, single management structure for the space needs of the military. And his action has successfully, I think, done that. And in truth, what's happened, you know, the military, actually, the people who are fighting this, the first proposal, budget proposal they offered for this Space Force was a gigantic amount of money that was absurd, because all it is an office. Really, you already have the offices, you already have the people employed, you just want to reorganize them into one office, so you really, the additional cost is not going to be a lot. But they were coming up with billions, $5 billion over the next 5 years. Well, that's all been dropped. It's already been dropped. There's now serious talk in Congress to go with the least expensive option, which would just reorganize the offices. And that's what we're talking about. We're not talking, that's the heart of the matter. And that's really what I'm in favor of. And that's what the military, the good people in the military are in favor of, because it would streamline, hopefully, how the military runs its space operations. Now, this is government and it's a bureaucracy, so I'm not a tremendously hopeful it'll be very streamlined, but at least the movement is in that direction right now.
So that's like a division of the Air Force, like the Marine Corps and the Navy.
Yeah, I mean, remember the Air Force originally was a division in the Army. It was the Army Air Corps.
Right.
And eventually when it became obvious that it really should be its own branch, then it became its own branch. But in the initial stages, no, it was a division. So this would be a division. They might make it a division in the Air Force, but the way to give it some clout in the bureaucracy is be able to have it have a direct line to the president or a cabinet position, and rather than have to go through the branch, because the branches have been pulling it willy-nilly for their own purposes. And so that's the thinking. And so that's the heart of this issue. And people get so caught up in Trump's, I've said this on your show and I say it on John Batchelor's show and I've written about it on Behind the Black repeatedly. You've gotta be able to separate what Trump says from what he does. And you gotta pay a lot more attention to what he actually does, because what he says is almost routinely a negotiating ploy for what he wants to do. And if you focus on what he says, you will miss what he really is doing. And that's just to describe what he's really trying to do.
Is any of this possible in a divided Congress, do you think?
Oh, well, actually it might be. Because this is, to a certain extent, this whole Space Force, in a sense, what Trump has done is he's given his, quote, enemies in the Congress, the Democrats, a way to look good by opposing the military branch of the Space Force with cadets and laser weapons and weaponizing space. No, we just want to reorganize the bureaucracy to make it more efficient. You get the Democrats saying that, and Trump will say, sure, I like that idea, let's do that. And he'll get what he wants. So actually, I see this as very possible, and that's what I've seen in politically happening right now. This actually could happen. There's a lot that's in the way of it with the sad partisan politics I see coming from the Democrats. Their Trump derangement, they're focused so much on what he said and their dislike of him that they sometimes can't have, they're completely insane. But I think in this case, his negotiation ploy is working.
I'm going to read you another email from George, who is in Huntsville. And while we're waiting to see if anyone out there has a telephone that they know how to use.
It would be nice, wouldn't it? I even made a point on Behind the Black to say, hey, readers, call in. I'd love to talk to you.
I mean,
to actually talk to me.
I like phone calls much more than emails. I like interacting with people.
Me too.
But the younger people don't want to interact. You know that.
They'll sit at a dinner table with their smartphones texting each other. They can talk to each other across the room. You know.
My younger son Michael years ago did a skit, and they acted it out at some theater in L.A. I forget what it was, of a young couple going to dinner together,
yeah.
And. They're texting back and forth. What do you like on the menu, Sarah? And she says, this looks good.
This is all texting.
This is, and they're right across the table from each other. You know, and everything is texting back and forth. And then the waiter comes up and wants to take their order. And, you know, the girl says, do you have a cell phone? What's your number? And then they start texting the order and the, you know, medium well and this and that. And, the, you know, the whole thing was about 8 minutes long. And it was,
that's brilliant.
This is the younger way of doing it. Well, we don't get a lot of text messages on the show because I don't give out my cell phone, but I do get a lot of email. So, George is in Huntsville. And he says, I am curious as to your thoughts. If you think the U.S. is actually any time in the next decade, which would mean the end of 2020, going to put humans on the surface of the moon?
No.
Well, that's a quick answer.
No,
we move
no
on to the next
we're
topic.
Not put anyone on the moon by 2020. And in fact, even if Elon Musk does what he says by putting that Japanese businessman on a trip around the moon, a circumlunar mission, using Starship and Super Heavy, that won't happen till 2022 at the earliest, they've said, and that would not be landing on the moon. SLS isn't going to launch with people on it until 2024, probably. No,
I think George meant by the end of the 2020s.
By 2029, let's say?
Yeah, I don't think he meant
all right,
by 2020.
All right, well, that's a different question, and that's a lot harder to answer. Yeah, okay. All right, George, I'm sorry.
Let's say 2030,
that's a very interesting question, and I actually think it's very likely that, yes, Americans... Let me rephrase that. I think it's very possible that Americans can get back to the moon by 2029. But it's going to require NASA, once again, getting out of the way. If we rely on a government program to do this, it won't happen. Because there's no way it's going to happen with SLS. It just ain't going to happen. It doesn't have the capability. It's too expensive. It's too slow. It's just a mess. So that's not going to make it happen. So the way this is going to happen is if the federal government gets out of the way and lets the competition that we see going on right now blossom and grow. And because that competition is beginning to blossom and grow, I see real possibilities of that actually happening. I think it's really very, very likely that it's going to happen before the end of 2029, but it won't be by a NASA rocket, and it's almost certainly not going to be a NASA program that will accomplish it because they just can't do it.
What about the role of the Gateway? Are you supportive of that?
It's a piece of crap. it's a total joke. It is once again an example of the people in our government and in the big space companies not having the slightest interest in serving the needs of the nation, because that thing is going to lock us into an orbit around the moon. We won't even be there very much. It'll cost a fortune. It won't launch when they say. It'll be just like SLS. It'll be a jobs program, billions a year spent for very little accomplishment. And even if we get it in orbit around the moon and we have astronauts there maybe a week or two every few months, all they'll be able to do is look down and watch at the Chinese building their military, their base. Not just their military, their base, their lunar base. Because they're focused very much on getting to the surface. Why NASA wants to focus on going into orbit around the moon is absurd. It's stupid. I'm really upset these days at what I'm seeing coming out of our government in these matters, and I want to say so. Part of the reason it's happening is because the big contractors, Lockheed Martin and Boeing, want to justify the money that's been spent and given to them for SLS and Orion, and they need a mission for those rockets and capsule, and the Gateway gives them that. And I should point out that neither SLS or Orion can really do much about, I shouldn't say they can't, but Orion is surely not a way to get to the beyond Earth orbit. It's a ascent and descent capsule. That's all it's really designed to really do. It's an ascent and descent capsule. It's a very expensive ascent and descent capsule, and so because of that, it's not a very efficient use, but it can't get us to another planet. It's not designed for that. And so they're trying to justify those very expensive boondoggles for the last 15 years. And so they came up with Gateway, and that's what they're selling. And it's a boondoggle. It's a waste of money. It's a jobs program. It's not exploring the heavens.
Will the Democrats in the House kill that program?
That's an interesting question. I'm not sure. They might. They might. I posted something on Behind the Black about 2 weeks ago coming from the new science panel run by the Democrats in the House. And that panel said they was very blunt language about SLS and Orion, about the mismanagement in that program, its high cost, its lack of results, its incredible incompetence on a lot of places. And they said if things don't happen soon, and this was put in writing, we're going to consider canceling the entire program. That was also referencing James Webb as well. And so that's very possible for political reasons they'll cancel it. It won't be for the interests of the nation. It'll be because they can say, blah, ha, we killed a Trump program. But nonetheless, it'd be a good thing. You know, this whole commercial crew exists because there were people in the bureaucracy under both the Bush administration, the second Bush, and the Obama administration who pushed for it. So it was not a partisan decision. It was actually pushed by bureaucrats from both parties over time, appointees as well as people within the bureaucracy who were not political appointees. So you did get it from both sides, as well as within the bureaucracy. So when I talk about the bad management in NASA, I don't mean everybody. There are people there that have the right idea, but unfortunately they are fighting a battle with others who have other agendas that aren't to our benefit. And that's what Gateway is. When they had the name, I loved it when they had the name for a short while. They were calling it the Lunar Orbiting Platform Gateway, because that abbreviation acronym was LOPG, and that so quickly turned into FLOPG. It was brilliant, and I really liked it. And I knew that's why they changed it, because they were hearing people calling it, most of me, calling it FLOPG, and they had to get rid of that. That was no good.
Ben in Denver, Colorado, and listeners, we're still available for your phone calls instead of emails, 866-687-7223. Ben says, how do you think the National Space Panel and all of what was put in place with President Trump and the National Space Council will handle the bipartisan Congress?
The National Space Council is a bit of an overblown game. It's a political committee created to sell the bureaucracy. I was pretty disappointed when I watched the first session, and I've been less interested in watching their later sessions, because it's very clear they were staged events to sell specific bureaucratic ideas. Some were good. Some of those ideas were good, but nonetheless, it was staged, and I just get tired of watching things that are staged. I have better things to do with my life. It is there for the purposes of trying to convince politicians and Congresses. It's using the way Congress and the Washington functions to apply political pressure to shift the debate in certain directions, and some of those directions are good ones. The whole Space Force thing and the reorganization of the military's bureaucracy around space has been, I think, relatively well handled by the Space Force, by the Space Council, to push those changes through. And the effort by the Space Council to try to streamline the bureaucracy that commercial space has to handle has at least laudable goals. I'm unconvinced at this moment in time whether it will succeed, partly because of Congress and partly because of the bureaucracy in the executive branch as well. I'm not sure they can actually, with the way our country is structured right now, where the bureaucracy has more power sometimes than elected officials, I'm not sure we're going to be able to push a change there. But at least the Space Council has been pushing in generally the right direction. But, you know, it's once again, it's a political game. It's kind of like the speech tonight by Trump. Once I realized that they're playing, they're just playing PR politics, where they just simply want to have your attention for a while, like it's a sports event, then I get less interested in paying attention, because it's not substance. It's sizzle. There's the old saying, I prefer the steak to the sizzle. And this is a lot of sizzle here.
You'll enjoy this short, brief question.
Okay.
Helen is in Pittsburgh, and she says, Bob, I'm wondering if you have a non-space life at all. Did you watch the Super Bowl?
It's a good question. No, I didn't watch the Super Bowl. I was a very big spectator sports fan up until 1994 when I lived in New York City. My oldest friend had season tickets to the New York Rangers. We had a Sunday season plan for the Mets for literally decades where we went to every Sunday game. I attended the Mets clinched in 1969, September 24th. I still have my piece of turf. I attended the 1986 World Series in which, for those that follow sports will remember Bill Buckner's allowing the ball to roll under his hands and the Mets winning. But after 94 and the strike, I said, I'm pox on both your houses. Both the owners and the players are not interested in the fans. And, you know, if you're more interested in your money and not in my entertainment, then you can get your money from somebody else. So, and partly at that time, I started to get interested in no longer spectator sports, but actual participating sports. I started to become a caver, do cave exploration. And rather than sit and watch someone do something cool, I've been doing cool things instead for the last 20 plus years and, gotten to do exploration. Me and my wife moved to Tucson partly because we love outdoors and hiking. And we do so much hiking, and that's one of the things we were doing this past weekend. One of the things we were doing, I'll tell you the other thing we were doing on Sunday during the Super Bowl in a minute, but one of the things we do is we hike a lot. And so while we'd be here, I noticed that there wasn't a hiking guidebook in southern Arizona that gave you circuit hikes, loop hikes. There were a lot of good guidebooks, but none that were circuit hikes. And there were in the East, and I said, this is a need that needs to be filled. And since I'm doing the hikes and I'm a writer, this should be a really easy book to write. And so I did. And so we did a lot of hikes, and I wrote a guidebook. So you can get it on Behind the Black, Circuit Hikes of Southern Arizona. If you're going to come hiking here, it's a great book to have. So we love to do outside stuff. And on Sunday, instead of the Super Bowl, this is Tucson. It's world famous for its annual gem show, rock and gem show that goes on in January and February. And so my wife and I and two friends went to one of the numerous tents all over the city. It's not just in one building. It's scattered all over the city. So we just picked one particular location, and we went and we spent the day walking up and down aisles looking at spectacular rocks and fossils and gems and jewelry and a lot of really cool stuff. And in fact, we looked very seriously at a very nice gigantic geode mounted on a stand that we might buy to put up in an alcove in our house because it just looks spectacular. So to answer Helen's question, yes, I have a life outside of space. I don't like to be bored. I'm doing something all the time.
Well, I used to go to that gem show in Tucson, and it is really special.
It really is.
And I'm not a caver by any means, but I have been to several of the tourist caves around Tucson, and it's a great outdoor area. I love the dude ranches and the horsebacking in the desert and all of that. It's a great outdoor place.
You can't beat it. And because I do cave stuff, I get to do I get opportunities to do things that normal people can't do. Like I've been in Karchner Caverns several times, not on the official tours, but I've been there to do lint cleanup. You know, people's clothes drop lint, and they want to keep it off the trails. So they have times when cavers can go in there and help clean up lint. I've gotten some private tours given by the place in exchange for the help we've given. And so these tours have allowed us to get an inside view of the cavern. Same thing at Colossal Cave here in Tucson. We clean up the lint, and they allow us to explore the cave beyond.
I bet you could come clean up the filth on San Francisco streets. Have you ever thought of that?
Not in the slightest bit interested.
So you're
that gets into an area of politics, which I generally don't want to talk about on your show.
If you're cleaning up lint in caves, there's a need.
There's a difference. In a commercial caves, the commercial cave actually exists to protect the cave. And so the lint cleanup is a bonus in trying to protect the environment. In a case like San Francisco, the politics of that town and California has been designed to destroy the economy, the livelihood, and the freedom of the people that live there. Their goal, not just the government, but the people who vote for the government, the general population in the in places like California, their goal, it seems to me, is to turn California into Venezuela, and they're working very hard and getting very close to succeeding.
How does
you describe the disgusting situation in San Francisco, which is common knowledge? It reminds me of New York City back in the 60s and 70s, same situation where the public and the politicians that were voted in weren't interested in really making that, weren't interested in the interest of the cities or the states in keeping them good, and so therefore they fell apart, and that's what's happening in California.
You have another caller on.
Sure.
But
a caller.
I mean, I've been into caves, and I don't notice lint coming off my
clothes. No, you wouldn't see it necessarily, but if it isn't cleaned up on a regular basis, it accumulates in gigantic amounts, actually.
Really?
Oh, yes. When I do the cleanups in Colossal Cave, which wasn't designed as carefully as Kochner was to protect the cave, and that's not a blame on Colossal, so this is a long history of learning how to do these things, but because of that, we go in with shop vacs and vacuum cleaners to sweep it all up. And
wow.
Literally, you get pounds and pounds, and you can, it's like lint out of your washing machine.
Your dryer.
Gigantic amounts. Huh. But if you, in Kochner, because they designed the place to reduce the amount of lint enormously, you don't see it. And there's, if we go in and do a lint cleanup, we spend a whole day cleaning up lint, 20 people, if we get a pound or 2 pounds of lint, we've gotten a lot. So they've
Amazing.
Done a very good job.
Let's see who your caller is.
Sure, let's do
that. Hi, caller. Welcome to the Lint Space Show. How are you?
This is Marshall, and I could not pass up the opportunity to get you guys back on the space topics. I have not seen or heard you talk at all about the different tunnels and windows in the, I guess there are lava tubes on the moon and on Mars. Have you ever done any major studies in that area?
Well, I did talk about it earlier on the show, the posts that have been up on Behind the Black in the last week about the pits on Mars. When I do my, I'm finding that I'm actually getting really a good view of what is known about the pits on Mars. You know, I delved through the archives of the Mars high-resolution camera on Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, and every time there's a pit taken, I note it. And I've written, if you do a search on pits or caves, Mars, on Behind the Black, you'll see numerous articles. And, in fact, the post I did just last week listed some of the more interesting links, so you can find that just in the last two weeks of posts. With the most recent post about this very spectacular pit located on Mars that is really interesting because it's accessible and it appears to be the drainage source for a really large canyon. Really very spectacular. I only found out about that image because one of the top planetary geologists researching caves on Mars, by a guy named Glenn Cushing at the USGS. I've interviewed him in the past, and I've written about his stuff in articles for Sky and Tell and elsewhere. Well, he emailed me to say, you know, I've got a whole bunch of really spectacular images that no one's ever seen, and I haven't had a chance to highlight in any of my science papers, and I'd be glad to send them to you. You can put up on them Behind the Black. So he sent me a bunch. And it was interesting to look at the ones he sent me because there were at least two in his bunch that I had already highlighted on Behind the Black that he said no one had seen before. But since I go through the archives, I found them. And I saw them, and I said, that's really cool. And so I highlighted them, and I talked about them. But among his were some that I had not seen before, including this one that I highlighted in a post today about a potential lunar colony. And I'm going to post a few more. But that I found that I had spotted some of his unknown pits on my own says that I'm beginning to get a pretty good overview of the overall field. And that's really cool. and exciting, because that means I'm getting more knowledgeable about what we know and don't know about the caves and pits on Mars. The undeniable fact is that when we finally establish colonies there, I think the first colonies are going to be built in some of these underground facility places, because it's just the environment is easier to work with. You don't have the swings in temperature. You have a radiation shield above your head instantly. You don't have to deal with that. There are just so many technical reasons why it's better to start out building in a cave. And the other possibility, which is what I noted in my post today, it's called The Location of a Future Martian City, is that this particular cave is very clearly was, it sure appears like it was a major source of water. It was a resurgence, a cave resurgence of liquid. Probably water. And with that in mind, there's a very high chance that you might find ice, provide you easy access to the underground frozen ice water table that it probably exists most places on Mars. Mm-hmm. That's a reason to go there.
Yeah, that's exactly what I wanted you to talk about.
Thank you, Marshall.
I'll try to be generous and let somebody else talk to you if they don't want to.
Okay, thank you for calling.
Thank you, Marshall.
Appreciate
Bye.
It. Listeners, Marshall has gotten off the line, and there is still time if you want to give us a call, 866-687-7223. And there is one further sponsor that we want to thank, and that is Celestis. And remember, they're still the only proven provider of Memorial spaceflight services anywhere. And you can go suborbital out of New Mexico. You can go orbital out of the Cape or Vandenberg. You'll soon be able to go to the moon again. They've done one mission to the moon. And you'll soon be able to go to probably deep space and Mars. If you don't cremate, you can use DNA. It's a great way to memorialize and honor a loved one and have a really incredible closure to the great life that they have lived. And you can put in a little bit of your DNA on the flight with your loved one so you can symbolically make the journey into space with them. For more information, check out Celestis.com. Remember, I am their customer, and I believe in their product very, very much. And tell them you heard about them on The Space Show. Bob, 2019, is it shaping up to be a really different kind of space year, or maybe more of the same incremental improvements, changes?
I think 2019 has the potential to be a majorly different year. In my worldwide analysis of the launch trends that I did in the beginning of January, I noted that this was the first year in literally since the fall of the Soviet Union that the nations and the worldwide global launch industry had more than 100 launches in the year. And looking at what the various nations and companies worldwide are predicting they're going to do for the year, there's a pretty good chance that this year will set a record for the most launches ever in a year, ever, since Sputnik. And that is really only the beginning, because once again, this revolution going on with the small sat rocket companies and small sats has the potential to actually create more launches than you can shake a stick at. And if that happens, it's going to be, to put it mildly, quite exciting. And once again, the more things you put into space, the more launches you have, the more opportunity you have for development, for innovation, for new ideas, for all the things that would make manned space and big payload space possible, even if they're only doing small sats. It still increases the chance for all that good stuff. So I see that. I see this year as having the potential to be a major game changer for the future. Having said that, I also recognize that life doesn't always go as we wish, and it's just as likely that it'll be a flub this year for any number of reasons. Look, I'll give you an example. SpaceX. SpaceX hoped to do its the range of 20 to 30 launches 3 years ago they were predicting, and then they had the launch failures, which put them in delay. They hold up for several years. But they finally got it done. They got, you know, more than 20 launches and 18, you know, and that setting records no company has ever done before. And so I think it'll happen even if it doesn't happen this year, but this year has the potential to be pretty spectacular.
You have another caller.
Oh, good.
And hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you? Where are you, please?
Hello there. This is Charles Lurio.
Charles, hello. Nice to hear from you.
Yeah, how you doing there?
I'm doing just great, Charles, other than my whining and complaining about what I think NASA's, how NASA's
yeah,
about future. But I'm doing pretty good.
I share your sentiments, if not always your vehemence. On the other hand, I can get to be a minute myself about various things, but maybe
yeah,
slightly different ones. You know, I'm what really is, I think, emblematic of the change that I hope will go on and accelerate is this whole thing of Musk changing the design of the Starship from the composite systems to the stainless steel system with the transpiration cooling.
Yeah.
Which is going to be really an interesting thing. I hope it'll prove out.
Oh yeah. I haven't talked about that. And oh yeah.
I think that's really exciting. And of course it will, as I was speaking to somebody who has actually a fair amount of background on work in that was done over the decades on that. You know, it's not a simple 1-2-3, system, but, if anyone has the this person's remark was that if anyone has the strength and the resolve to work out the problems, it's SpaceX and Musk.
Yeah.
And doing that, you know, it's like doing the iPhone versus how many ways can we make your landline better for endless decades, you know, or something like that.
You know, it's interesting. There's two things I learned recently on my various travels, and both relate to exactly this subject, Charles. One, when I took the Vector tour and saw how they were using carbon, you know, carbon wrap to make their stages and even their nozzles and fuels, and Jim Control was explaining the various issues they have to deal with, it struck me as this is a very complicated thing. It's a very complicated thing. It's very expensive, and it's very fudgy, and I'm not so sure it's the best approach. That's the first thing I learned. But, you know, this is what's hot today, and that's what everyone's going for. And the second thing I learned when I was in Buffalo, I was at the Niagara Aerospace Museum, and they showed me an old Agena engine they have. And the way they cooled the nozzles of that engine was brilliant. They literally drilled holes through the metal structure and ran fuel through those holes. And it's hard to describe how they did it because you have a curved structure, but the holes were straight because they angled them. And I don't want to get into the specifics there. It was just brilliant. Mm. But they actually were using this exact concept to cool the metal as the engine was fired. It's just, you know, in a different manner. And so it's the engineering has existed in the past in some manner and therefore can exist in the future.
It's just that everyone has been afraid to try things, whether it be that or probably dozens of other concepts that have been, you know, somebody has sketched out or some obscure program they did. Some testing, limited testing, and, you know, the Air Force or NASA or whatever at some juncture. But never, it's always too risky to actually try to innovate in practice.
Right. right. I mean, I've said this on this show, David. I've said it on Behind the Black, and I've said it on Bachelor's show. I can't count the number of managers and engineers who told me for almost 40 years that it was impossible to effectively make a first stage reusable by landing it vertically. It just is impossible. It's not going to work. We don't even want to waste the effort to do it. And, of course, we know now how much how stupid that thinking was, or blind it was. And it was exactly as you say, Charles. It was an unwillingness to take risks, to be
That's
innovative
right.
and creative and to take risks. And Musk has demonstrated that risk-taking, this is rocket science. You can't do it well if you don't take risks.
Just to think of where we could be if we had been taking some risks for the last 40 or 50 years is it's really not a happy thought.
One of the reasons, though, risks were not being taken is because after the, and this is the one of the themes that the lessons that I discovered in writing both Genesis, Story of Apollo 8, and Leaving Earth. Which was that the space race taught this nation the worst possible lesson. It
Absolutely.
Taught this nation that what we want is a space program managed by our government, and therefore you didn't have private enterprise, and you didn't have competition, and therefore which drives innovation and lowers cost. Instead, you had a government-run program dictated from above. It was a Soviet style. We copied this. We won the Cold War, but we copied the Soviet model in our space program and in a lot of other ways. And that's why nothing happened for half a century.
I used to say that that the Soviets had, in a way, more competition in their lunar program than we did in ours, albeit they had less resources, but their design bureaus were furiously
competitive.
Yes.
The way they designed their design bureaus was to make them compete against each other. This is in the Soviet era. What they
right.
did is they literally had design bureaus competing for the same kind of projects, and that forced quality work and innovation. What the United States did when it decided to copy the Soviet model with our giant space program and its bureaucracy is we did what the mobsters did during Prohibition. We divided up the work between different territories.
Right.
So each NASA center had its own responsibility independent from the others, and the others couldn't touch its responsibility. That was their turf. And that, of course, means you don't get any competition. I should point out that one of the reasons that Russia has failed in the last decade or so to really become a successful capitalist nation is because after the fall of the Soviet Union, they abandoned the competition between the design bureaus, and they went with the same model
yes.
I just described in the United States, where they
yes.
divided up the territories between the various design bureaus and did not allow any competition, direct competition.
And they've absorbed everything into mega organizations. And it's a shame, really.
It is a shame. I mean, they made, I thought, a very bad decision, the Putin government, about 5 years ago to decide to consolidate it all into one corporation. What they should have done is they should have said, you know what? We're no longer going to allow Energia to be the only one to build manned rockets and manned space. We're going to allow other companies to do it. They allowed them to invade their space, and they weren't letting anyone do that, and that's why they haven't had any competition.
Yep. Well, you get what you put in.
Yep, you're
right.
If
you put in the wrong model, you get a heck of a lot less than you could be getting. So
that's right, and that's where we are That's where we've been in the United States. So that we've gone around in circles and not getting much accomplished.
Yeah.
We've been depending on a government program. And when everyone asks me, how can we help the American space program, I want to puke. I do not want a space program. I don't want a program.
I agree with you. Some
government agency running things. I want it to be as chaotic and as competitive as possible, where nobody runs things, but everybody who has got a company is following their own particular dreams to make money and to make and to get into space. And you get that kind of thing, you get real competition, you get real innovation, and you lower costs. And that's what we're seeing now, which is really glorious.
I was interested in your comments about Blue Origin earlier, because you were indicating that because of their work with DOD that they were, or maybe I didn't quite get this right.
I'll go into it again if you want, Charles. I didn't go in detail, but I'll explain it more specifically if you want.
Yeah, well, I mean, and how it's affecting their overall development.
Yeah. I don't have inside knowledge. They're very closed mouths about what's going on at Blue Origin. But what I do notice, coincidences. And the coincidence I noticed was when the Air Force announced these developmental subsidy contracts to both ULA, Northrop Grumman, and Blue Origin, giving them lots of money, both ULA and Blue Origin, within a week of that, but separately, to try to separate the two, but I saw it, both announced that Falcon and New Glenn would be, their first launches would be delayed by a year. And in one article, I think there was actual hints that the cause of that was the new requirements that the Air Force was imposing on them for developing that rocket. And I tied that on, so I see this as possibly a hindrance to clean development at these two companies of their new rockets, because they've got to meet Air Force requirements. And what reinforces that conclusion is what I saw, I can't remember his name, he's a German or Austrian guy who's one of the chief engineers at SpaceX. He gave presentation at a conference. There was a video of it I posted on Behind the Black, in which he very honestly said, we turned down that contract money. We decided we don't want the Air Force's money because of the requirements they're going to impose on us in building super Heavy and Starship. And that reinforced my belief that the contracts were going to be a hindrance to the development of these new rockets.
By the way, apropos to hindrances to launching commercial crew, the latest story within the last hour or so on Twitter is a launch date no earlier than March 2nd.
There was a comment. One of my best commenters, a guy named Kurt Hilliard. He keeps really close watch on these things, and he actually spotted the FCC application by SpaceX last week to renew their FCC license for March 2nd. But he also noticed that their present license expires the day before, and so it could have just been that they were covering their bets in case they get delayed. You've heard that it's now certain, that doesn't surprise me. But
I did not assert that. What I saw was a note that I think it was Michael Sheets, you know, the fellow who's now, I think he's running for one of the major business magazines or something, I forget now, but there was an indication that this was more, he said that it would be announced tomorrow.
Well, we'll have to wait to see what happens tomorrow.
But the person who forwarded this retweeted this tweet said, you know, mentioned the FCC thing and said, let's see.
We'll have to see. What I noticed is that they've now delayed SpaceX's unmanned test launch test mission to the same month that Boeing's is scheduled. I haven't heard any talk about Boeing's being delayed, and that's when I get suspicious about the politics in NASA favoring Boeing. I just,
well,
I can't help myself.
I can't. I find it extremely. I agree. I have to say that this whole thing about the, I don't understand what this whole thing is about having problems with the parachute.
It's a lot.
In particular.
I'm sorry, Charles, you're more discreet, but when I begin to sense someone's lying to me, I get really pissed off. And when someone's using those lies to do harm to my nation or myself, I get really angry. And I'm beginning to believe that's what's going on here.
I'm
Hello?
Charles?
Yes?
Oh, we lost you for a minute.
No, I can hear you guys.
We can hear you now.
Yeah. Okay, well, I moved my head about 3 inches. That's probably the problem. At this location. No, I'm sorry they dumped the propulsive landing for the Dragon 2. But nonetheless, I think it probably Musk doesn't mind it that much as long as he because of his acceleration plans for the Starship and so forth.
Yeah, that may be so, but you know, part of it is NASA is his biggest customer, and he has to make them happy, and so he's not going to
hypothesizing. You know, I know, obviously, he has to make them happy, I totally agree with you. They have to be, you know, in total. They have to be yes.
It's a chicken egg question, actually, Charles. It could be that the reason he's accelerating Starship Super Heavy is because he realized he couldn't do the things he wanted to do with Falcon Heavy and Dragon because of he was locked in with NASA. And so he decided, well, I can't do the things I want with them. I'll start a new rocket, and I won't take the government's money, and I'll get development capital and do it privately, and then I'll be able to do what I want. It could be that. It could be the other way around.
Either
way.
but I mean, there was. I don't know where I saw this, but I thought I saw something with one of the SpaceX people saying that they might actually have fewer Falcon flights this year.
Yeah, that's true.
Due to the slump in the geosync.
Yes. What you heard is I've heard too. And I actually didn't mention that when I was talking about this slump. That both SpaceX, across the board, it looks like there are going to be fewer geosynchronous large satellite launches. SpaceX, over the last 2 years, has cleaned out its backlog, its manifest that it built up over the last 5 years. And now that they've done that, it was Glenn Shotwell who said this at some point, they've cleaned out their backlog, and so they do not expect to have quite as many launches in the next year. And so that's true. I've seen that too. And that's part of this whole change. It's also part of the just general, they had a backlog and they had to clean it out, and they've done that, and so you have fewer launches. That's what happened to China, too. China had, set this record last year for the most launches ever by their nation. They're not going to come close. They're going to not quite do as many this coming year because they've cleaned out their backlog and they don't have to make as many launches. Same thing.
Yeah, well,
David, it's after it's more than 2 hours now.
Should we
continue? I'd be glad to keep talking.
Charles, do you have anything else? Otherwise, we're going to wind it down.
No, I'm just about run down at this point. It's after midnight where I am.
All right. Thank you for calling, Charles.
Thank you very much, Charles. It's a pleasure to speak to you anytime.
Bob, how would you wind it up? Summarize what should we have talked about that we haven't talked about?
Oh God!
I
don't want to go for another 2 hours. You know?
No. Well, I mean,
you know me. I can go for another 2 hours if you want me to do that, but I don't want to do that. It's late, and we should save it for our next show.
Well,
there's plenty to talk about. They should go to Behind the Black, right? Or listen to the Space Show, and they'll keep, you know, these other things will come up. I have no idea what we missed. I'm sure there's something, but we'll save it for later. Right?
Is there anything you want to tell us to look out for, or anything like that?
Well, you know, the number one thing that I'm talking about, you know, is this commercial space launch, and whether NASA and our government is going to continue to act against the nation's interests to block it. And I see nothing changing there in their effort to block it, and it's pretty disgusting. And I bring it up a lot because I think that the American people should start to complain about it loudly. And if they do, we might get some changes. I'm not tremendously optimistic about that, but that's at least where I'm coming from.
All right. Until the next time, my friend.
Yes, David, always, it's a pleasure. I hope you all
happy birthday and happy funding to you, and we will definitely stay in touch.
Yes, David. Till next show.
Till next show. And listener, we're back again, and we're going to be here on Friday. Remember, there is no Hotel Mars this week because John is not feeling very well. So hopefully he'll be back next week. And we're back on Friday. So everybody have a great week, a safe week. Good night from Bob. Good night from David. And keep looking up.